Hi, this is Marco Brambilla, the director of Demolition Man, and this is the DVD version of the movie Demolition Man.
I'm Joel Silver, the producer of Demolition Man, and I'm talking with Marco Brambilla, the director of Okay, here we start. We're starting.
So this first image here was to create immediately this, you know, the idea of L.A. being a demilitarized zone now, and the Hollywood sign on fire seemed a very appropriate way to get the audience into it immediately and show how far L.A. had come into the violence and the kind of internal, kind of almost like a civil war going on. We were shooting this scene right after the actual L.A. riots, about 6 months later, so we had a lot of reference material to look at, and we just kind of extrapolated from what was already happening and taken it into more of a theatrical realm.
We took these Humvees, we found Humvees, we pinned them black and white. They looked really good as black and white. As a matter of fact, I think they should do that everywhere.
They've used them in quite a few movies since, actually, as police vehicles. And this was a Chinook helicopter. That's a military helicopter we had to get in Seattle, and then we painted it.
The original intention was that this be a blimp. We're going to have this be a blimp that kind of silently came in over the fire, but they felt with the blimp it would be too dangerous with the winds because
exactly.
Of the fire, so we might lose everybody.
As it was, the helicopter created a 120-mile-an-hour downdraft at ground level, so even the steel drums on the ground that we were using as dressing had to be bolted down so the extras wouldn't get killed by the drums flying around. I was in the helicopter chasing the big chopper, and we got caught in the downdraft briefly, and we went down like 50 feet immediately because it was very, very dangerous scene to shoot. Chasing that big helicopter. This was an optical. We found a building in downtown that we could actually implode. That hadn't been done in about 40 years.
It was a Department of Water and Power building that was a great period building. Of course, we destroyed it, tearing apart the fabric of original LA.
Now, the guy who designed this rig to make it possible for the stunt to happen in motion with the helicopter won an Academy Award. And this is
Kenny Bates.
Penny Bates, exactly. And then we cut to Stallone on the roof. Now, see, the editing here, this whole sequence is cut very quickly, and this is something that's come, you know, from the old James Bond movies, where in the action movie genre, you have a big beat in the prologue, and everything, you kind of draw the audience into the movie by creating this kind of visual collage that sets everything up quickly. And it really, you know, kind of, you try and shock the audience into the story. And it's something that's, you know, been done in a lot of action movies. It works well because it draws you in immediately and you don't have time to breathe, really. And the idea here was that every shot would be, you know, 3-4 second shots, jump cut.
And Sly's also very good at this because he gets what he's got to do. I mean, he really is being this legendary demolition man action cop.
He's unstoppable. Like, he's absolutely, you know, they finally found Simon Phoenix, Wesley Snipes' character, in his hideout here, and Stallone will stop at nothing to get him. And Sly's very good at all. I mean, and any time there was any choreography to be done with action sequences, it was always 2 or 3 takes, and then we had it immediately. And they worked very differently. Wesley at first actually didn't want to do the movie. He had very hard to get Wesley to. Then Joel, who won't take no for an answer. We went down. I remember we went down to the
set of Rising Sun, yeah.
And we finally showed him the script, and he got excited about the project, and he was signed on. It was really great to have him because his energy level and Sly's energy level being completely different. Like, Sly works in a much more kind of, you know, constant force, and Wesley's just bouncing off the walls all the time in this scene. He also improvises a lot, and it really created this great dynamic between the two.
And this had to take care of us for a long time. We didn't see each other again until much later into the movie. So we had to really set up a dynamic that we then were able to get ready to pay off finally at the end of the picture.
This is Dennis Rodman actually got his hair ideas from this movie, from Wesley.
At one point, as we do this scene, we kind of hoped that, you know, essentially Wesley and Sly could both have a fight where they actually are on fire. But they didn't kind of...
they didn't take that too
well. They didn't buy that concept. But it was still, that was the idea, is that they're fighting with each other in the middle of this, in this kind of sequence where there are flames everywhere, and wanted to have them literally catch on fire and beat each other up. I did it later on in another movie called Double Tap.
See, these two guys will stop at nothing to kill each other. So the whole world is collapsing around them. The building's on fire. It's about to explode. We've set up these C4 explosives all over the building. And but these two guys are so obsessed with annihilating each other that they just don't seem to care. And that's very important to the setup of the movie, because when we come back into the future, nothing's really changed except that Phoenix has a particular advantage that we build into the story later on.
I'll keep that in mind.
He also says I'd lose my head
if it wasn't attached,
which is kind of a setup for later. There's the C4, and his fly is running out of the building. Have a chance to really do some demolition. We in the past had Lethal Weapon 3. We'd blown up a building that was already set for demolition, and we just kind of like piggybacked it and shot it as it was being blown up. But if you could call a explosion being more artistic, we were able to design our own explosion in this movie, because we essentially got the building and hired the demolition team ourselves, so we were able to really make a work of art.
This was like the art direction with a wrecking ball, basically, and we created this kind of amphitheater. It looked like that morning, because the sun was coming up with the flame bars and the strike, it looked like Dresden. It was very interesting, like this magical kind of setting, and in a way, in its own way, it was very beautiful, actually, to see this structure kind of collapsed into itself. And now we have a scene here where we establish the fact that Stallone's character is going to be blamed for...
Kind of he was set up by Wesley. That's Steve Kahane, by the way, that's been in... He happens to be Dick Donner's cousin, but he's the captain in all the Lethal Weapon movies as well, so...
We had 13 cameras set up for the explosion of the building, and with all the safety checks, it took about 4 hours just to go through the safety checks that were necessary before we could actually blow the building up. It's very time consuming, but you don't want to get it wrong. You have to have enough coverage, so that I think we used about 7 or 8 of the angles in the cut, actually. See, at this point, Wesley's so great. He's improvising here. He's ad-libbing, and he really gets under Stallone's skin in this scene here. And he just doesn't. Wesley's the type of character that just doesn't care what's going to happen to him as long as he brings Stallone's character down with him.
See, the idea was the idea of the last mile. How, for years in prison movies, the actor would be walked to the lucky chair at the end of the movie, that he'd take the last mile. And our idea here was to literally open the movie with that. So here is Sly in the main titles being walked essentially the last mile to the electric chair, but unfortunately it's not really...
That it's not the electric chair. And the idea also here was to give the impression that this technology that we're going to reveal later is not fully tested yet. So we're seeing the cryoprison, as we called it, still being fitted with the last-minute additions and kind of
it's being
technology.
Built. Matter of fact, all around the set are pieces of the set that we eventually did use to finish the set, kind of lying around to show that it's...
Yeah, we were behind schedule, but finishing the set, and it actually helped because we shot this before we... there's a claw mechanism that goes into the middle of the set that wasn't there yet.
And we had been working for a long time for a gelatin, a substance that we could use that Sly could kind of get into that would, be this kind of gel, this fluid, and we'd worked with a lot of different gels, and Sly was concerned that he not essentially...
Not be able to go to the bathroom for a week, go to the bathroom for a week. This set is really great. I love Ken Adams' work from the James Bond movies, and this was how to show someone going into cryogenic sleep in a way that was more theatrical, let's say, than something like 2001 A Space Odyssey, where it's treated with perfect scientific accuracy. And in this film, I wanted to do something that exaggerated a little bit and also made it quite terrifying. So these are actual hydraulic doors that are shutting down around Sly. There was a lot of very heavy equipment that couldn't just be pushed aside. So we had a lot of safety precautions in case he got stuck in there, because there was a very limited amount of air. And then once we started piping, this is actually glycerin we used at this point, and we started putting the glycerin. That's actually Stallone in the container, with the container shut at the top, with the glycerin coming in. So we devised a system where he would let us know if he thought we were in trouble, and then we could disengage the top of the pod. And this is to convey the impression of a drowning, so to make it as terrifying and psychologically claustrophobic as possible. And there he is now, his last breath. And the warden has never seen this before. So you can see from the look on his face, he'd never really seen anyone subjected to that before. This is an idea from a Kurt Vonnegut book. He wrote a book with a substance called Ice-9 in it, which is like a catalyst to create the final stage of the cryogenic procedure where the liquid turns into a solid.
We have to set up because you paint out that blue thing drops into the ice and into the glycerin, and when it hits it, it just turns it into a giant block of ice.
And this is the big time.
The passage of time. So we see where we are, 96.
And the title sequence here. This is a life cast of Sly made by the people who did all the animatronics in Jumanji as well. And they did a very detailed life cast using this kind of translucent urethane, which looks very much like skin.
It was extremely real. As a matter of fact, Sly wanted to make sure the...
genital
area was very large and appeared to have a very strong masculine side of him there. Of course, you don't see that, but he saw it.
And this was shot on a snorkel camera, and in order to make it look like we were navigating through the material, we had to fill the studio with so much smoke that we really couldn't get the smoke density in the whole studio, so we had to build a tent just around the area where we were shooting, and the smoke was so dense in there you could... if you held your hand in front of you, you could hardly see your hand, and we had to wear gas masks, and it was very time-consuming to shoot this.
And Sly had a lot of these made for the Planet Hollywood, so you see them around, those mannequins.
The other idea here is, you saw it on the video screen earlier, the prisoners are actually going to be rehabilitated during cryostasis, so this is a new way to treat the criminal problem, and not only are the prisoners frozen, making them easier to maintain and spending less money per cell, if you will, they're also being rehabilitated so that when they are defrosted, eventually they're better citizens.
And you can see what Margaret did here is he pulled the camera through the whole new, finished spanking, especially spanking new. There's Wesley going by.
That shot took a whole day. Andre Gregory, we would pull back. We were using two cranes.
He broke his leg. He was kind of...
And he was limping with the cast, and then we'd finally get the shot correct. And then maybe his lines would be wrong, or we'd have to redo the take again. So that took a long time.
That's the first shot of the ultralight, the vehicle that GM has devised as the future car of the future, which they let us make the molds of.
Yeah, Joel got GM to donate all the vehicles you're going to see in the film. And the most expensive part of doing a futuristic movie is not really the sets. It's really building futuristic cars because they actually have to work. And in this case, we were very lucky because Joel managed to convince them to let us have all the cars for free. The ultralights we had to actually build, but everything else you see is actual show cars that they would travel all across North America. And we had to pay insurance costs and that kind of thing, but we didn't really have to pay for the vehicles.
All these effects, these eye effects and the screens and everything, they're all working. All these things are kind of working.
Self-drive, that's the self-drive car. And this is Sandra Bullock. She came on to the movie after we originally had Laurie Petty cast in the role. We'd actually shot a scene with Laurie, and it just wasn't working, and we ended up being very lucky to have Sandy join the project.
We're trying to show here that even though we're in this incredible future where everything is so nice and pleasant, there still is things like graffiti that exist, and even though people use graffiti, that they can be taken off immediately by the...
That's like the subway trains in New York, like the graffiti-proof subway trains. And even though everything seems to be perfect and beautiful and placid, it's boring as hell, and there's still some people underground who are rebelling, in this case,
are hungry as well, because they're watching a food truck go away. And
Dennis Leary there, and he's the terrorist of the movie, and he's the foil for the dictator who runs the city. And
We were shooting out in the valley. We found this.
It's a medical.
Marco found this medical building, and this is a set. Of course, we built this set.
Sandy brings this great humanity into the movie because she's got this really charming presence, and we've seen a lot of very high tech things and a lot of pyrotechnics visually. And Sandy kind of draws us into the future now in a very human way, and I think that's part of the reason that we're able to follow so much in so little time, because we've set up this whole world now. We've set up the rebels. We've set up the way the police station looks here. And she really draws us into it in a very intimate kind of way.
She's very cute, and we kind of like her, and we want to, you know, and she kind of likes the things that we kind of like. So, you know, and it's...
And she's frustrated, too, because she's frustrated that nothing seems to be happening, because the society, they've sacrificed a lot of personal freedoms in this new society for complete safety. But along with that, they've lost a lot of the kind of interesting things that may go on, especially in a police station. So basically, these people are relegated to giving up parking tickets and that sort of thing. And the police station was also designed in a way to, you know, the opposite of what you would expect a police bullpen to be.
So it's almost like air traffic control.
Exactly, or a library. I mean, yeah. It's very quiet. This is where we first see the morality box, which is...
great
so
show.
Every time you swear, you get summoned. And this came from Dan Waters' original script, where he had some great kind of exaggerated, like political correctness unchecked.
Yes. Tell me something, Garcia. Don't you get bored co-tracing perps who break curfew?
Lenina Huxley is the name of her character, and she's obsessed with the 20th century. Especially the violence in the 20th century. So when we reveal that Stallone is coming back, it's like her hobby come to life. And her partner here can't believe that she's still, you know, yearning for the days of chaos and violence when they have such a utopian society now.
She says she just wants, shouldn't something happen, she says. And he says no. And she says, oh, she said, what I wouldn't give her some action. And then we then go and see some action right away, because we see Simon Phoenix getting, you know, we're saying that he was frozen before the repeal of the probation laws, so he had to be rethawed to have
through a minor loophole, an often overlooked loophole.
So he is allowed to have probation hearing because he, when he was frozen there, he didn't have probation. There was still probation. And there's that chair standing him up.
And Wesley here, he ad-libbed on one of the rehearsals. He did the whole thing in Spanish, which I thought was really funny and very appropriate, because he was very disrespectful and he just drove the warden crazy. So we had him actually do it in Spanish, repeating everything the warden says.
As we find out here, too, that there, I mean, the way we view things, I mean, there are voice commands for words or commands that you use to unlock things. So he'll say the word teddy bear, and for some reason that word teddy bear unlocks the
handcuffs. Mm-hmm. Now Wesley's a black belt in karate, and he really was, you know, very helpful in doing these fight sequences. What I found happening is we had to actually slow his movements down, because his natural movements and the way he really fights it were too fast for the camera. So, but the choreography is very authentic and he's very good at it.
He also doesn't know why he can fight so well and why he can do this so well. And we find out later that he kind of learned this while he was in a deep sleep.
Now, this shot wasn't always in the cut. At one point, I think we had to take it out of the cut because people felt it was a little too graphic. But I think, you know, the violence in this movie is very cartoonish, and everything is, you know, a little bit askew and a little bit tongue-in-cheek. And this was certainly the most graphic thing we showed.
Yeah, you too.
So now, for the first time in, I think, 20 years, there's been a murder-death-kill in the city of San Angeles, which is what we refer to as San Diego and Los Angeles combined in the future. Okay, so now we see the police station in action for the first time, and the analogy to like an air traffic control tower is very accurate, because everything's done with remote sensors all over the city. All the citizens in San Angeles, which is Los Angeles and San Diego combined, in the movie, are coded. They have a microchip implanted in their hands, so they can tell instantly when someone's died, or if their life functions have changed, or if they're sick, so they can dispatch a doctor or a coroner or whatever. And the pacing here slows down deliberately to let us get into the way the police works in the future, and to set up the fact that once Simon Phoenix is going to be at large in the city, they're going to be pretty well helpless to stop it, because his arsenal of techniques and weapons is going to be completely different from anything they're used to working with. And in this scene, we see and we hear a description of someone dying as a list of what's happened to him. And the reference for the voiceover was this kind of, we wanted something very kind of monotone, almost like a, you know, like a air flight demonstration. And she's listing the things that have happened to the warden. And it's quite terrifying and quite gripping, actually, when you hear it with the voiceover and then you see the person finally collapsing. So they're able to pinpoint the location where it happened. And now she's cross-checking to see who the recent reanimation subjects were. And now they discovered that it's Simon Phoenix. The only person in the scene who actually knows who Phoenix is, there he is, and he knows him from the time that Stallone knew him. And he knows that they're in for big trouble.
A criminal the likes of which you have never seen.
Hold that thought, Zachary Lamb.
Now this is when Lenina Huxley, Sandra Bullock's character, really comes into her own here, because she's finally got something to do, and she's very efficient and very much an expert at working all this machinery, and she finds a way to track down his car and find out where he's going.
Declared his own kingdom in South Central L.A.
Now the computer graphics were done in a place called Video Image, where we tried to come up with what the next generation of a user interface would be. And everything is very, as you can see, it's very kind of user-friendly and very simple. So everything's based on graphics, and it's almost as if you took a Macintosh program, and it's like version 12 of the Macintosh operating system for a police station. And everyone in the police station has access to this information.
Tell me, L7, is the doctor's conveyance still in the parking zone?
The answer is no. Car missing.
So this is really the detective work in the future, and how they would solve a crime in the future. And they get very confident, because once they find the car and they know the car's missing, they dispatch the officers immediately, and they think they've got it solved here. Bob Gunton was very good to work with. I'd seen him in The Shawshank Redemption. And we really took his, you know, we shaved his head, gave him these very interesting eyeglasses, and made him this very exaggerated character. And again, that's the tone of the movie, is trying to take everything into like more of a cartoonish kind of realm without going too far, but playing all the dialogue very straight. So even though the dialogue is quite humorous at times, the actors are always delivering it very straight and with great conviction. That's what makes the comedy work, I think. This was all shot in Orange County and Irvine, in just south of Los Angeles. We were going to shoot in San Francisco and San Diego. We'd found a lot of very interesting buildings up there, but the budget didn't allow us to spend that much time away from L.A. And when I first went to Irvine, we found that in the 70s and early 80s, they built all these kind of industrial complexes and office malls, which were very appropriate for L.A. in the future, because the idea is that L.A. has been flattened by an earthquake, and everything you see is has been built very recently. So there's no real old architecture. It's all metallic, and everything's in tones of metal and glass. And the art direction that we use to enhance the streets, like these kiosks and the parking meters and the keyboards and all that, is all very monochromatic. There's, you know, if you look at the cars in the background, there's very little color in the cars as well. The idea is that people aren't, you know, the whole American love affair with the big cars with different colors and all that is gone, and people are more kind of conformists now. So it's not what color do you want, it's like what shade of gray would you like for your car. And this is when we see Phoenix receiving the last part of his programming message. So now we're aware that, you know, something's happened to him while he's been asleep, and we've got his programming's in action. But he doesn't quite know what's going on yet. He just knows he can operate all these computers, and he can find himself quite at home in the city of the future, but he has no idea why. And this makes him, you know, much more terrifying as a bad guy opposite when Stallone is eventually defrosted, because Stallone doesn't have those advantages. He's still operating on instinct and on what the way he's been trained in the 20th century.
Fuck you!
Your repeated violation of the verbal morality statute has caused me to notify the San Angeles Police Department. Please remain where you
are. One of the most interesting ideas about the script and subtext was the idea of the criminal mind and how, you know, you can't really fool with Mother Nature and what human nature is and how society tries to change that. And in this case, obviously, it doesn't work. Very much like A Clockwork Orange is one of my favorite movies, and it deals with that same kind of idea of tampering with the criminal mind and then finding out that you've actually made it much worse. And this scene was great, because this is probably one of the most comedic kind of fight scenes I've seen, where the cops actually use like a tutorial program to show them how to take down a bad guy here. I met this guy, Paul Perry. I met him in acting class, actually.
Maniac has responded with a scornful remark.
Approach and repeat ultimatum in an even firmer tone of voice. Add the words, or else.
Simon Phoenix! Lie down on the ground, or else.
Phoenix knows so much about the machinery here that he's able to activate that graffiti wall that we saw earlier with the graffiti bomb exploding, and uses it to kill one of the police officers here. This scene was all shot in one afternoon. We had very little time, because we had to control traffic, and then we had to do several explosions that day involving motor vehicles. So the light was going in and out, and we were losing a lot of time kind of waiting for the sun to come out and all that. And again, Wesley was so good at doing this fight choreography that we were able to pull it off very quickly. That's called the ratchet cable, which we used to pull the guy out of the car. And this is the last scene we shot that day. You can see the sun is very low now. We're just almost in darkness there.
Stupid.
I'm back. Here he is. See, what I love about his character is that he has such tremendous screen presence and charisma. So although what he's doing is quite violent, you know, we don't really, you know, we're not quite against him, because he is really more of an individual than anyone we've seen in the future so far, maybe with the exception of Sandy's character. And he's just kind of shaking everything up right now.
The vehicle's battery core.
The cars were all powered in the future. The idea was that the cars would be powered by fuel cells, and if you tamper with the fuel cells, you explode the car. So these matte paintings were done by Mike Pangrazio and Craig Barron, and very good matte painters up in Oregon. And we were able to do three or four paintings. One of the frustrating things about the film and the post schedule, we didn't really have as much time as I would have liked to tweak some of the paintings. Originally, there were very elaborate motion control shots involved in some of these. But again, because of budget reasons, we had to go with something a little bit more formal and static, which in this case kind of works, because the movie is set up in a very classical kind of way. All the references for the sets that I was looking at were more from, you know, the conformist or, you know, movies where you have very minimal kind of art direction and you're almost kind of forced to look into the frame to find something with texture. And that's very much in keeping with the way these people live. Looked at Jacques Tati's Playtime was another reference I used a lot. Nigel Hawthorne played Dr. Cocteau, who is this kind of seemingly benevolent dictator of the new city, and he's conducting a conference here with his colleagues, and we designed this set to show, you know, as if you were almost hanging on to the way people would interact at a boardroom, but with this new teleconferencing technology added to it. And these devices were all in these motion control motors so that we could program it ahead of time for each move. So when Nigel moves over to talk to Glenn over here, we can rotate all the screens simultaneously. But the programming had to be done all in advance, so the actors were actually taking some of their cues off the movement of the monitors, which was very awkward and very time-consuming because there was no way we could get them to synchronize unless we had programmed them in advance.
It was just... I mean, it was so... How could a man be so blatantly sadistic? It was fun for him.
I want you to do everything in your power to snare this agent of destruction. You have my...
We were talking, Joel and I were talking about the, you know, the for this role and who we would consider as an actor for this, and we thought, well, he probably should be British because we'd instantly get that kind of arrogance and that kind of self-confidence that goes along with that character, the way he was written. And we were very lucky to get Nigel in the movie, and he really brought a lot of class to it, and I think it was interesting to watch him work opposite Wesley, especially later on, because they're actors of completely different kind of backgrounds and disciplines, and it works very well together.
Satellite surveillance? A video bite on unsolved mysteries? None of them worked.
You see, the police station here, again, is all done in this kind of graphite paint. So we use these special paint formulations with actual metal in the paint. So everything always looked reflective and very monochromatic. So rather than having color to convey depth and shading, we used reflections because the surfaces were all very metallic. And now that you see them going into the archives. So everything, again, it's kind of what's happening now with the web, where everything you could want to know about anyone is archived in these huge computer drives, and now they're recalling information on Spartan and what he was doing in the 20th century. This was the video in this is actually the first scene that was shot in the movie. It was the first day of shooting that we used for playback.
This is your recommendation.
And right away, you can see Bob Gunton's character here. You can see that he's clearly not of the mind of bringing Spartan back into the fold. He wants to let the current system deal with Phoenix, and his colleagues here are trying to convince him to think otherwise. And they've convinced him. This is the thawing procedure. And this, again, this is something that was storyboarded extensively. I did, I think, over about 200 storyboards for this sequence. And the basis for this was somewhat scientific, but the idea was really to make it more theatrical and just exaggerate the idea of what an assembly line would look like. So this is basically how would a factory do this if we had, you know, 30 or 40 of these pods with criminals inside them. There would be a procedure and a kind of checklist and a process that would be completely automated, and that you could simply program these machines to defrost the people. And this machine here wasn't seen in the opening. This is something that was added once the cryo prison was completed. And this is something I was really struggling with, is how to actually show him being reanimated and being kind of freed of this capsule. And I decided the best way to do it would be to show it as an elaborate kind of 3D animation, so that we would show most of the crystal structure being cut away from his body with this high-tech laser beam, and then, you know, later go into the reveal, which is like the reference for this was the Botticelli painting, The Birth of Venus. We kept calling this like our Birth of Venus shot. And Stallone was very comfortable doing this in the nude, actually. He had done all his push-ups and pumped up before the scene, and we shot him on this hydraulic platform. Used this special thing called the ME system, which is like a mist generator, which generates very fine particles of steam to create this kind of liquid effect around him and this smoke around him.
This is within the powers of the police charter, sir. He can be released on limited parole and reinstated to active duty.
It's not enough to collect the 90s. You have to bring them back to life.
Dr. Cocteau said everything within our power. I can't think of a better idea.
That still doesn't mean it's a good one. This man comes from a dissimilar method of law enforcement.
Now this is where having Stallone in the movie really pays off, and the comedy we get in the film from having someone with his history in other films, and you know, we've seen him as Rambo and Rocky and all that, and the audience already knows what's in store here because his sense of aesthetic and his sensibilities are completely different from anything that would be acceptable in this new society the way we've established it. And immediately in this scene you see that he is going to have a very hard time adjusting to the new ways of the of San Angeles. Sandy was very, Sandy's compassion and her humanity really helped the story here, because we're dealing with these two guys who are obsessed with killing one another, and yet you have someone who's facilitating all this, and Sandy's giving it such a great kind of contact for the audience. It really connects to you the way she feels about the way she feels sorry about what's happened to Stallone's character and how he's lost his wife since he's been frozen, and how he's just found out about the earthquake, and now he finds out about Simon Phoenix as well.
We've become a society of peace, loving, and understanding, and we are, quite frankly, not equipped to deal with this situation.
There have been no deaths of unnatural causes in San Angeles in the last 16 years.
The Santa Barbara, Los Angeles...
There's a lot of exposition here about a new city and the way the government works and that sort of thing, but this seemed like the best scene to put all the exposition, because we're kind of introducing this character that knows nothing about it. It's always the tricky thing with movies like this where you're setting up a whole different world, is how do you draw the audience into the world without talking too much about it and kind of calling too much attention to the exposition. In this scene it felt very natural, because the way she does it with her kind of awkward, she's a little bit intimidated by Spartan here, you know, she's a little bit scared about what may happen, but she's also very excited about the possibility of working with him. So, she's giving us, the audience, all this information that we need to know, but at the same time, it's working with setting up her relationship with the Spartan character in the scene.
Mr. Phoenix has risen from the ashes.
Uh-huh. I tracked that dirtbag for 2 years. When I finally bring him down, you turn me into an ice cube.
All the sets for the cryo prison were built in such a way that whichever if I was shooting even a two-shot like this, I would always be looking into the main atrium. So, again, the production value of the whole set would be almost in every shot. So we had very few shots where we were looking at a blank wall or looking into a corner. We always had, you know, the full kind of production value from the set that we built on the larger stage at Warner Brothers and spent a lot of money on. So the studio was also very concerned that we were, you know, spending a tremendous amount of money on this big set, and we had to have enough action take place there. So I devised a way to be able to shoot, to move the camera around the set with this thing called the techno crane, which is like a telescopic camera crane, and get shots which were very fluid and kind of navigating around the set. And we used a lot of that in the previous scene. Between when he's defrosting.
You guys know him, but you're out of toilet paper.
Hey, did you say toilet paper?
Oh, they used handfuls of wadded paper back in the 20s.
I'm happy that you're happy, but the place where you're supposed to have the toilet.
See, the dynamic here between the three characters is really good, because you've got Huxley, who clearly adores Spartan and his achievements. Like, he's very respectful of certain things, but at the same time, society's changed so much that they can't help but laugh at how he doesn't understand the three seashells in the bathroom. And that's something that thing that most people remember from the movie is the three seashells, which was like this idea that I think that Dan came up with in the first draft. The original draft of the movie was by Dan Waters, who wrote Heathers. And he also wrote Batman 2, I believe. And a lot of his material is very, it's very kind of tongue-in-cheek and very self-referential and very hard to do in a big movie. So we had a script that Joel and I both really, really liked, but at the same time, given that this is a, you know, fairly big budget movie, there were certain things that were a little bit too oblique or a little bit too arch that we had to get rid of, but a lot of the things like the morality boxes and the three seashells all stayed in the script, and it gave it a great flavor.
Unfortunately, Simon Phoenix was not coded. While you were sleeping, everyone in the city was...
So this is Stallone learning about the new police department.
Organically bioengineered microchip be sewn into the skin.
See, he's scratching his hand there. He doesn't know why he's scratching his hand, but yeah, he's actually being implanted with the chip.
What you police officers did before it was developed.
We work for a living. This fascist crap makes me want to puke.
What do you think you're scratching, caveman? You really think we'd let you go without control?
This set here, the police station, was actually an office building with a circular atrium in the middle, and we built everything into it. Originally, it was going to be a freestanding set on stage, but again, we were able to use a location that gave me some of the production value from the actual building and then add to it and save some money that way.
We don't need the Neanderthal. Our computer has already examined everything.
See, the great thing about Bob Guy, he's always very proud of the way his system works. Like, he's not willing to admit that there could be any kind of flaw to the way he does things. Now he's being challenged here.
But that's really fucking stupid. Do you think he wants to start a business? Phoenix is going for a gun, plain and simple. Trust me, he's going for a gun.
Who cares what this primate thinks? Resonate some understanding. The only place a person can even view a gun in this city.
The costumes were done by Bob Ringwood, who had done the costumes for Excalibur that I'd seen. These were metallic kind of chess pieces and things. We used a lot of metal in the police officer's uniform. And this is one of my favorite sets, the museum, where we took the idea of something I'd seen in Rome a long time ago, where they'd recreated ancient Rome as a kind of diorama in this museum. And in this case, rather than showing a pristine city or, you know, any kind of important artifact, the museum is built on this excavation of an old kind of sleazy L.A. alleyway, and that's being used as kind of the centerpiece of the museum. And this is the Hall of Violence, where we've got actual pictures from the L.A. riots hanging on the walls.
John Spartan, even if Simon Phoenix was able to locate the cache of firearms, it would be impossible for him to remove them.
She's right. They're located in a maximum security armory exhibit.
Just a hunch, so trust me. It's a cop thing.
What am I?
See, Spartan's character is ready to get back into action immediately, but he's got a few things he needs to learn here before he can get right back into it. I tried to make all the technology very consistent, so the type of screen graphics you see in the car and in inside are all designed in this, using, again, the same kind of interface. So it's as if, you know, everything's being programmed ahead of time, and the police is used to working with a certain program, and they just stay with that. These shots were done as process shots, so I shot these all on stage using rear projection plates. We went out to Orange County and shot some rear projection plates and projected them through the windows. This was because it was a time-saving way of shooting the scene, and I think when you've got three actors and complicated dialogue like this, if you can make it look convincing enough with rear projection, and I think because this is a futuristic movie and the tone of it is a little bit exaggerated, I could get away with some of the, if there were any inconsistencies in the rear projection or anything like that, I think you could get away with it, so I think it worked out pretty well. The cars were also very difficult to transport because they were fiberglass and we had them breaking down all the time, and it was very complicated to actually shoot towing shots with the real cars, the real ultralights that we had designed for the movie. So now this is Phoenix has found his way into the armory where they show the ancient weapons here, and it's like a kid in a candy store. And again, Wesley's energy is really great because a lot of this was scripted, but an equal amount was his kind of ad-libs and improvisation that he would throw in, and he really got into the character in a big way, and I think he really connected with the idea of, you know, someone finding himself instantly very comfortable somewhere where he has no business being. And again, the museum staff here is very courteous and very formal. This is a, they have no reason to suspect anyone would try to break into a showcase here. How much do you weigh?
How much do you weigh?
Well, I happen to weigh 50.
Please vacate the museum. You see all the costumes there. The costumes were, we used a lot of reference from Japanese designers, and also the idea that the ozone layer had burned away even more than it has now. And so a lot of the outfits were created to kind of cover as much of the skin area as possible. So it has a Middle Eastern feel to it as well. And he instantly finds, of course, he finds the most high-powered weapon possible immediately. And we get a brief description of the weapon here because, of course, the museum has another tutorial kind of program. And these are things you find now in observatories or museums where everything's going online anyway. So what we were, this was, you know, 1992, 1993, before a lot of that was being used as much as it is now. And it's interesting how much has actually already happened. And Phoenix, again, feeds off this kind of mayhem and this kind of chaos. So, and the more disruptive he can be, the happier he is. Patience is not one of my virtues. Again, this is back on the location, Irvine. We took a building. This is like the, I think it's called Fluor Daniels Chemical Company. We took the headquarters and transformed it into the museum. Just some very simple dressing. The idea was to use a lot of the same kiosks and parking meters and graphics all over the city, so it would look like it's very consistent and everything's being transformed in a very homogeneous kind of way. So it's not like there's not a lot of individuality in this new society. And in the art direction, you see, you know, all the things you see in the background, we repeat in different locations. What we got? Does it work?
Guess so.
They have him trapped in Section 8.
I doubt it, Huxley. Now make sure that building's clear.
I think we set the smoke alarms off in the building that day because they weren't prepared for us to have smoke coming out of the doorway, and we had to stop shooting for a while there. And this is cutting back to a set. This is, again, shot on the lot. And this entire set was connected to the excavation set you saw earlier. So, again, being able to do Steadicam shots and handheld tracking shots from corridor to one atrium to the other area was really helpful, especially in these action sequences where you can connect all the different areas here. This is the first time they've seen each other in 30 years, and we've got a big action scene here where they exchange dialogue, and rather than having them, you know, originally this was supposed to be more of just a confrontation without the gunplay and without some of this choreography, but it felt very self-conscious and it felt very flat because we were kind of trying to tell the audience, you know, what would the first thing Phoenix would say to Spartan in the future. And it became, you know, it just became very flat, and I thought rather than do it, that the first thing they would try to do is probably kill each other. So we came up with this action scene where the dialogue is kind of interspersed with a lot of gunplay and a lot of stunts here. And then to take it to the next level, I had the set below the glass table here designed in such a way that it would be almost like an obstacle course for these two characters. So I had my production designer come up with every conceivable exploding object and kind of every cliche from a lot of, you know, contemporary action movies that you've seen, and cram them into this underground set. And it's kind of like a Rube Goldberg thing that happens here. You can't see them directly, so then he figures out the lights can come down. And then everything kind of goes like a domino here, and the pacing really picks up. So now we find them basically in an environment very similar to where we first saw them at the beginning of the film. Now, all this time, yes, Phoenix has been waiting for his gun to charge up, so now he's able to use the new version of the gun here. And this was an optical effect we did. And this is actually a computer effect where we introduced some distortion into the frame by twisting the original image around. There's not a lot of computer effects in this film. This is before we were able to do as much with computers as we are now, but there's a couple of shots where we were able to use some of the ray techniques and that kind of thing. And that's a really that's actually Sly ducking away at the last minute from a, it was a plastic post, but it still would have been very painful if he hadn't ducked away at the right time. Every action sequence you see in the movie was extensively storyboarded, so I basically stayed away from a lot of dialogue sequences in terms of storyboards, and maybe the every dialogue scene would have five or six frames that were boarded. But in a sequence like this, I had about 300-350 frames all storyboarded, then put into a computer where I would do a kind of pre-edit on an Apple computer, and then actually determine what would be necessary to have in the scene. So, because it's very expensive to shoot stuff like this with all the pyrotechnics and that sort of thing, so you want to be careful about how much you overshoot. So by using the computer, you're able to kind of pre-visualize it very clearly and only shoot what you need. Our noble facility has been desecrated by hooligans. And this is back at location. This was actually very close to where we shot the entrance of the museum out in Irvine. And this is where the plot really starts to unfold, where we see the purpose of Simon Phoenix and why he was brought back and what his function in the movie is.
I don't think so.
And in the programming phase, not only has he been programmed with a lot of knowledge about what the way the city would work in the future, but he's also been programmed with a safety in case he would turn on his new boss here, Cocteau. And we see it in this scene. This scene was shot actually in three separate days. I had to go back and get an intercut here of the gun, and we shot this on a lot outside of just outside the offices here with some trees in the background.
Then go and do your job.
So Cocteau and Spartan instantly don't hit it off at all, and I think Spartan suspects something about him immediately, and he knows he knows Cocteau is responsible for creating the cryo prisons and creating that whole new method of law enforcement, so doesn't have a lot of time for that. And, again, Nigel gave the role such a gravity and such a kind of presence to it that, you know, a lot of these kind of Bondian villains get very predictable because the, you know, their agenda is always very similar, and I think you got to find a way to have the character, you know, be interesting on his own terms and have his personality be interesting, because, you know, essentially the agenda here is has already been established and revealed to the audience, so we're kind of waiting to see how Stallone's character is going to react to it and how he's going to be able to overcome it here. And you know, Cocteau is always very calm on the outside, and he's always very controlling. I mean, the whole idea was that this is the type of character who would want to control every citizen in San Angeles, having coming up with the coding techniques and the cryo prisons.
John Spartan, welcome. Now, in honor of your arrival and your protection of the sanctity of human life, namely my own, I would like to invite you to join me to dinner tonight. The both of you.
See, the exteriors were where I had very little control over art direction, such as in this scene where you just had basically a park setting. The contrast of the film and the look of the film were very important to keep it, again, very cosmetic. So everything we would see in the new city
is very cosmetic and very kind of almost like liquid lighting, and I used these special filters that had just come out at the time to give the film a little bit of softness and some kind of halation highlights. We used, you know, slow film stock, so we wouldn't have a lot of grain. We'd be able to get, you know, good shadow detail, but still, again, everything looks a little glossy and a little bit too perfect. So I went, you know, a lot of films at the time were being shot with a very kind of gritty look, and the idea here was to go against that and to make the police station look like a Neiman Marcus kind of department store with very soft lighting and everybody looking, you know, with a very cosmetic kind of feel to it.
It should be just a matter of TikToks before we act.
More importantly, we already have a backup plan.
And in the exteriors, I would often use smoke in the background to blow away areas of the frame where you didn't want to see or things that looked too present day that you want to eliminate. And the smoke would give it this lovely kind of veil and this texture that that you wouldn't be able to get otherwise. This is the convention center in San Diego. So although we weren't able to shoot a lot of first unit in San Diego, I was able to send my second unit crew down there to pick up some shots, like the establishing shot you just saw and the rear projection plates for this scene here. And this is Huxley and Spartan's big date, big night on the town here, and he finds out that Taco Bell has now become the restaurant of choice, and it's gone quite a bit more upscale than it is now. The idea is that everything's become kind of franchised, and you have, you know, like Starbucks and Domino's Pizza and Taco Bell have become the corporate entities that are responsible for restaurants, and everything's gone very, very upscale. And, originally, we looked, you know, when we first had the draft, we were looking for a restaurant that would participate in R-rated film, and Taco Bell ended up, they weren't afraid of the rating, and they thought it would be a good idea to do the tie-in. We actually shot some commercials that featured the new Taco Bell image. Like, they had come up with a new kind of signage and a new kind of look, corporate look, and it was introduced in conjunction with this movie. So the restaurant in the film actually has the logo that they're really using now.
Quasi-facetious, but you do not realize that Taco Bell was the only restaurant to survive the franchise wars.
So?
Now all restaurants are Taco Bell.
Way.
This location was an aerospace company called Hughes Aircraft out in El Segundo, and I redressed it. We created this kind of a very upscale version of Taco Bell. And this is just part of the whole kind of the way pop culture has changed in the future and how we've become more commercialized, but at the same time, everything's gotten more formal and more pristine. So the references for this were some of the upscale restaurants in New York, and you know, they have Taco Bell shakes alongside glasses of champagne there. And we worked, the costume department worked with the people from Taco Bell to use their signature colors and all these kind of mariachi outfits. That's the world's smallest burrito.
I'm going to ask you to raise your glasses to the hero of the hour, my savior.
This is a classic type scene where you have, you know, the villain coming face to face with the person who's going to eventually bring him down. And this is very different from the rest of the movie because we're taking some time here to get to know the characters a little bit, and we're seeing Stallone's character for the first time kind of relaxed and adjusting to the new world, but then when he hears what Cocteau has to say and what his idea of utopia is, he's very offended by it.
Things were going when I went in. I thought the future would be a rotting cesspool.
Well, you weren't here when the real disturbances began. Civilization tried to destroy itself. The city degenerated into a total fear zone.
See, here you really get the sense that he believes that what he's doing is the right thing, and I think that's the key to having a really great villain, which makes him very terrifying, is that he thinks his course of action is actually good for society, and what he's done has actually improved the quality of life. In a lot of ways, it has, because, you know, in the opening of the movie, we show this L.A. having become very unsafe and a place where, you know, people can't live anymore, and this is what they've had to sacrifice. They've had to sacrifice certain personal freedoms to have this kind of very orderly lifestyle. But underneath it all, his obsession with control has made this society very hypocritical, and he uses his control over the city to be able to do things which are not part of, part of the ethics he preaches here. And, when he needs an assassin, because basically the story is about him, we pick up the story in the future where Cocteau is looking for an assassin to kill off his, the terrorist underground, Dennis Leary character. And clearly there are no assassins available in this future, so he defrosts Simon Phoenix.
During rehabilitation, the prisoners were not conscious.
I tried to populate the bar with a lot of models and, kind of photo models and give it a very kind of cosmetic look again, try to make it very upscale.
Now, Spartan, where are you going?
Bad guy's about to do bad things. He's just one of those hunches again.
So where you can't take Spartan anywhere here. You know, his detective work has kicked in, and now he sees something about to happen. And sure enough, this is one of the raids that the Wasteland people, this is what we call the underground city, and these are kind of the forgotten citizens, the people who aren't perfect enough to live above ground, and who are actually starving, are attacking the depot here and taking food back underground. And this is a very important scene because you see that Spartan realizes that these so-called thugs from underground are actually very desperate and kind of tragic people who are just trying to get some food. This was actually Sly's personal trainer that we used in the film, and he was his judo instructor. He was the first person Sly beat up. The scraps, as we called them, these people called the scraps, all their wardrobe was made from, automotive parts and tires and just thrown together from any kind of garbage that you would find underground. It was almost as if from living underground they have no way of getting any resources that are manufactured, so they just use kind of whatever's at their disposal. And, this guy's wearing shoulder pads which are made out of, tire treads, and this is where we realize that he sees that all they were doing is looking for food.
That sheriff, who are those guys?
They're known as scraps. Outcasts and deserters who choose to live beneath us in sewers and abandoned tunnels. They're a constant irritation to our harmony.
They're nothing but thugs and hooligans. A society.
Now we see Huxley's characters getting very excited about all this, which she's just seen happen. She's only seen this in history books and on videotapes, so she's kind of getting away from herself here. The dress we had designed for her was actually made of stones and jewels, and it weighed about 40 pounds, so when she started moving around real quick, the seams on her dress started to split. That's why she's holding her arms down like that. This is a location in San Diego. The architect called Helmut John had designed this kind of trolley station built into a building. And again, that's a second unit shot we were able to get done in San Diego. And that had a lot of production value. It looked very Japanese, actually.
Look, I'm sorry I yelled at you back there.
Stallone, before we made this movie, Stallone had made a couple of comedies that didn't quite live up to his expectations, and one was called Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, another one was called Oscar, and audiences had a really hard time kind of believing in him as a, they just wanted him to be kind of this action star and didn't really buy into the comedy aspects of what he was trying to do. And I think in this film, because we're using a lot of the baggage he comes with, a lot of his reputation from Cobra and Rambo and all of that, and putting him in this kind of utopian future, I think the comedy works quite well because we're using him in a way where we've really not seen him before. And I think there's a lot of compassion here for him. Like, he's like a fish out of water, and he's a little bit uneasy about what just happened. And there's an attraction that develops between him and Sandy in this scene.
Subject change.
It was always a lot of fun to shoot the two of them in the car. They were always goofing around and having a good time. Became very close friends by the end of the shoot.
What do you need that for?
It's just one of those cop punches again.
This is Cocteau's office, which we saw earlier. We saw the boardroom earlier, and this is the actual office part of it. There was a large practical fireplace built in, and the ventilation system wasn't really strong enough to exhaust all the heat out of the stage. So this set got incredibly warm. This was about 105, 110 degrees in the studio when we'd be shooting, and we couldn't have the air conditioning on, obviously, because of sound. And it's very uncomfortable. It looks like a very comfortable place to shoot, but you can see in that shot proceeding, when you look at the top of frame, that there's actually smoke on top of the set because of the fire, so we were able to kind of control that a little bit. But it was very important to have this. I thought it'd be very important to kind of play this very kind of veiled, all these veiled threats kind of going back and forth between these two characters who are kind of dancing around one another, and at the same time you see this kind of raging fire in the background as a kind of tension element. This is where Phoenix turns on his liberator here. And it's very clear, you know, Phoenix's character doesn't really respect any kind of authority. And from the very beginning of the film, you're immediately aware that he's kind of this guy who isn't afraid of the consequences of what he's going to do. And his ambitions here are actually much more than Cocteau ever expected. And maybe he didn't read his file properly, maybe he didn't quite know how ambitious Simon Phoenix was when he chose him for the job. But in this case, he's going to be confronted with something he really doesn't want to deal with.
You're beginning to be more trouble than you're worth.
Oh, Raymond, don't say that.
Again, a lot of this material about becoming the mayor of Santa Monica and all that was Wesley ad-libbed a lot of that, and we did it in rehearsals, and then it was so funny we decided to put it in the script and keep it. And most of the time with Wesley, what I found myself doing, we would block a scene, and then, you know, Wesley would never sit still. Like, he always had to be doing something. There was this kind of manic energy, which was very appropriate for the character. So, you know, a lot of the blocking became much more dynamic once I started working with Wesley on the set. And the way he does it, I think it still feels, you know, like he's serving the narrative, he's giving us all the information the audience needs to know, but he's doing it in a way that's a little bit more eccentric. And sometimes with actors, you find that if you ad-lib or if you improvise too much, you tend to lose some of the core story. But with Wesley, he had a great understanding of what the story needed to be, and at the same time knowing how far he could go with the performance, so that it wouldn't really take away from the story, but it would just make his character a little bit more interesting or more aggressive. Now, this was actually the only scene in the movie that was shot twice, because it was originally shot with Lori Petty when she was cast as Huxley, and it was the first day of shooting with her. And then I had art directed the set with a slightly different look when we did it originally, and then once Sandy came on board and then we went back and reshot the scene, I thought I hadn't gone far enough with the amount of memorabilia and the amount of material in her place to make it very clear that she was really into this kind of junk culture from the 80s and 90s, and so we were able to really cram the set full of every conceivable article of just junk culture and violent posters and little tchotchkes from the past. Now this is where she asks him if he wants to have sex, and he thinks sex is the way it was in the old days, but she's about to surprise him with the new operating system for sex here. Because again, as everything else in society has changed and become more formal and much more safe, sex has also become something that's safe sex to the extreme. It's with no physical contact. I wanted this to look at the in designing the actual device they would use. I wanted it to look almost like a jewelry presentation, like something that, you know, you could buy, like the Nike version or, you know, the Rolex version of this machine, because it was actually almost like a, you know, like a luxury item. And so we designed this case that was almost like a jewelry case, and the devices themselves were very minimal. I wanted to keep it very kind of hardware free, so it wouldn't look like we were all of a sudden kind of overpowering the actors with like this huge headgear. And they'd done some really great work like this on Brainstorm, a movie called Brainstorm a long time ago, where they designed these prototypes for the way people would tap into their nervous system directly, and I used some of that reference. The footage you see here was shot at a company called Colossal Films in San Francisco, and they specialize in a lot of animation and do some commercials and commercial work. And I sent Sandy up there for a weekend, and we got some great material of her just kind of lit by strobe lights and multicolored lights, and there was very little processing that went on, but it became very sensual just from her expression and kind of flashes. You know, there was like 4-frame edits in there, and again, to Stallone, this is terrifying. Again, it was completely overwhelming, and when we cut that sequence, we found that, you know, even like 3-frame cuts, 2-frame cuts would work really well. And this is, you know, this is exactly the type of scene that Stallone's playing very much in type. Like, this is exactly what you would expect a guy like Stallone to be doing if he was put in this situation.
It is no longer done. The exchange of bodily fluids, do you know what that leads to?
Yeah, I do. Kids smoking, a desire to raid the fridge.
The rampant exchange of bodily fluids was one of the major reasons for the downfall of society. After AIDS, there was NRS. After NRS, there was UBT. And one of the first things that Dr. Cocteau was able to do was to outlaw and behaviorally engineer all fluid transfer out of societally acceptable behavior. Not even mouth transfer is condoned.
This is not allowed.
And this is where the comedy of the film really, I think, works very well, because it's almost like political correctness just gone haywire. And a lot of the things that are happening now in the 90s just extrapolated and exaggerated. But it doesn't stop the demolition man there. He doesn't quite understand what no means.
John Spartan, and I wish you to leave my domicile now.
This apartment building was designed in such a way that all the cubicles would be exactly the same. So the only difference between, you know, the apartments on the first floor and third floor, the penthouses, would be the way they're decorated. So he's just come from her place, which has this incredible kind of collection of junk from the past, and now this is his home. This is where he's going to have to live for the rest of his life. So this is the first time he sees his new accommodation here, and very sterile and very Japanese. We used a lot of references from Japanese architects and actual kind of office buildings in Japan and the type of materials they used to make it very uninviting and very cold.
Oh, he doesn't know how to use the 3 seashells. Happy Halloween.
Again, every home in the future here is completely wired into the internet. You know, data access is completely unlimited. And I guess for very secure communications, they still use hard drives. And here, you know, when you're designing like what the future CD would look like, it's very tricky because these things change so quickly. We came up with like this idea of these kind of stacked CD, miniature CD discs, which would give you kind of unlimited memory potential. There's like a wrong number in the future where you actually see what's... That was the penthouse pet of the year from 1995, I believe. And the yarn he's holding in his hand is his reprogramming. So while Phoenix was programmed to become the ultimate fighting machine and the ultimate kind of technological wizard in the future, his reprogramming was needlepoint, slightly less effective, and he doesn't quite know what he's doing here, but he's about to knit a sweater. It's great when you've got, you know, again, in creating this future, you can, almost anything goes. So the idea of these surveillance cameras everywhere really helped the story, and it made it very natural for him to do some of this kind of sleuthing by himself and being able to see what happened, what actually happened between Phoenix and Cocteau. This is, he made her a beautiful red sweater. This was shot at the Pacific Design Center in L.A. The architect's called Cesar Pelli. He just finished designing the world's tallest buildings in Kuala Lumpur now. He's a very famous architect. And we got some great, you know, really great locations in Los Angeles that just very spread apart. So we'd have to, you know, shoot a day in one area, then move during the day to a different location, then move to a third location often in the same day, which is not the best way for schedule, but when the look is important and you want to maintain this kind of consistent feel through the movie, it was very important to be able to, you know, just shoot what you wanted to shoot and not really see any old buildings. And it was very difficult to do, even in Los Angeles, to stay away from a lot of contemporary architecture and just go for something more futuristic. Which best suits their genetic disposition. And it would implant the knowledge and the desire to carry out whatever training was assigned. The way this was scripted originally, we had a lot more drive-bys happening, like exterior shots and things that would happen between, you know, that you would see a little bit more environment outside. But again, with the schedule and running out of time a little bit, we most of the car shots are all interiors. But I think the dialogue just carries the scene, and this is basically about, you know, other prisoners that Phoenix is thawing to form his new posse in the future. Can't be right. Access granted, Officer Huxley. Accessing Simon Phoenix, Deep File Rehab 65R, Urban Combat Kill, Torture Methodology, Computer... And although we know what Phoenix has been reprogrammed with, this is the first time the two characters are aware of what they're up against. Death, kill, explosives, technician, violent behavior. And this connects Cocteau to the plot, and this gives Stallone's character a very clear idea of the fact that Cocteau is probably behind some of this, because he would be the only person to have access to these reprogramming in the cryo prison. We were the first film to shoot inside the new LA Convention Center. This was designed by I.M. Pei and Associates. And we were very lucky to shoot there because they had just finished building that terrazzo floor, which was worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. So we actually had to cover the whole floor when we did our dressing and then be able to shoot just at the last minute. And then we cut to the set on stage here. These again, these monitors were very difficult to shoot because this was when liquid crystal monitors were still, you know, not a very, you know, developed technology yet, and very hard to shoot from different angles. So you can see, depending on how high my camera is or if I'm off to the side, some of the screens get flared out a little bit, and we had to build a special screen that could get shot out. So actually, the one which gets shot out is just a transparency. And we did a match cut between the moving image and then cut it, when the bullet enters the glass, we cut to the transparency, and you're not able to tell that he hasn't shot the monitor out. They're very each one was very, very expensive. I really like this master because it's like playing this whole scene out as a master and kind of revealing the gun in the video screen and then carrying it on with the kind of fluid camera move here and then coming around. It really sets up the confrontation between the two characters in an interesting way. And, you know, when you can do that with a master, it's always nice to not have to cut away and to kind of set up the geography like that. Originally, I had the whole shot cut, the whole sequence cut as a master, and then we punched in on a couple of close-ups, and eventually we went, you know, a little bit more cutty in here to get some of the tension back into it. But I think it's very effective. This is, again, this was shot in a kind of downtown plaza in L.A., and this is one of the, you know, we had sunlight again. One of the tricky things about shooting in L.A. is you get so much sunshine, and I really wanted the movie to have more of an overcast feel, and we pushed the schedule originally. We were supposed to shoot earlier in the year where we would have had a better shot at getting overcast skies. But then, you know, once we started shooting, it got closer to the summer, and we ended up with a lot of sunlight. So I tried to stage as many of the scenes under trees or anything I could do to just keep, you know, kind of hard sunlight off the characters. And for the close-ups like this, we'd be able to tent the whole area. And Alex Thompson, my cameraman, was very good at being able to control the light as much as possible, even in these kind of exteriors where we didn't have a lot of room and a lot of flexibility. A lot of this is shot on a Steadicam, which is, you know, kind of, I think it's kind of shorthand when you're shooting on Steadicam. Everything, you sacrifice a little bit of precision, but you get some dynamics and some speed out of it. And in this location, it was the only tool we could use really to get around the obstacles and up the stairs and kind of carry it off as, again, as a master with a minimum of intercutting. But the film, I stayed away from using the Steadicam as much as possible because the film really wanted to have more of a classic kind of formal look to it, especially in the above ground scenes where the architecture and the graphics really are as important to the frame as anything. And the compositions, I wanted them to be very controlled and very kind of sterile and reflect this new society and the way you know, people behave and the way they interact with one another. This is the beginning of the journey into the wasteland. So this is like the abandoned city where no one goes anymore. And not very many people know about this. So the population at large in San Angeles doesn't really know that these people exist, aside from the fact that they, you know, burst up through the ground occasionally to get food, and they're like these kind of repressed people. And we shot a lot of this at a power station in near Pasadena. And the reference for all of this was, you know, what would the archaeology of the future be? What would we find below the ground that these people could use to live in? What would they dress in? You know, what would you know, all their the propping be, and how would it be, you know, derived from something that was originally underground? And we used things like old aircraft containers, like luggage containers from aircraft would become, you know, like capsule hotels for these people. And the look here is, you know, again, the lighting is very different from anything I had done up on the surface, and it's got much more contrast, and the color palette is also very different, because when everything on the surface is more kind of green, blue, and neutral, this it has much more of a kind of a earthy feel to it, and used a lot of steam in the set and a lot of kind of smoke to get the idea that it was a very uncomfortable place to live. Now, of course, Stallone's character feels much more comfortable here immediately, and we set up some props that he's going to use later in the film. So just in the same way Phoenix was able to access his arsenal earlier, we see Stallone access his tools of the trade here in the wasteland. And, you know, these people are very cautious and very wary of the police, and they're not angry or aggressive, but they're just intimidated, because any interaction they may have had with people on the surface has always been a bad one. And so these are very, you know, seeing the three police officers is very intimidating to them. And this is where he finds a mint condition Oldsmobile in the garage here in the wasteland. We had a tie-in with General Motors because they provided us with all the futuristic vehicles, so we ended up using I wanted like a classic muscle car from the 60s and 70s, and we ended up using this Oldsmobile as Spartan's car later in the movie. Working with Dennis Leary was really interesting. I think he'd only made one movie before this, and you know, he's got this great kind of presence and this comic timing when he's doing his a lot of the stuff I'd seen on MTV, and when he kind of rambles on about the hypocrisy of society. And the character was rewritten when we got him in the movie to work with, you know, his image and his kind of take on life. And in this scene, I think he really kind of blossoms. Like, this is the first time in the movie where you hear him talk about what Cocteau's been doing on the surface and how terrible things have gotten.
Let's take them and dump them up top. They're only down here to spy on us.
Wait a minute. You're the guy outside Taco Bell.
Yeah. What do you want?
There was a subplot that got cut out of the final version of the film, where Stallone had a daughter, and she is actually one of the people in the wasteland. But since Stallone's character has been frozen all this time, she's actually older than he is in the scene. And it was a really interesting moment, because it was good for the subtext of the movie about this whole cryogenic suspension, how it would affect people. And the reunion is very interesting, and then it's interrupted by Phoenix, and we ended up considerably shortening that, and then eventually kind of eliminating that subplot entirely.
You live up top, you live Cocteau's way. What he wants, when he wants, how he wants. Your other choice? Come down here.
Dennis was great in this scene, because you get it in two takes. You know, he's done so much stand-up before, and this was very similar to what he'd done in stand-up performances. Sometimes people come
with me. All I want to do is bury Cocteau up to his neck and shit and let him think happy thoughts forever.
And I got bad news. I think he wants to kill you.
This was Wesley's reunion with his elite criminals here, and originally I wanted to shoot this scene with like a circular dolly move all the way around the pool table, but the location was a little restrictive and been too time consuming to do that. We had very little time to shoot at this location. We were shooting, you know, two or three major scenes a day at this point, and with all the special effects and the smoke and the backgrounds, the extras in the background, found that, you know, I had to be a little bit more economical about the shots here. But I think Wesley's personality and his kind of momentum in the performance really holds the scene together. And I think in retrospect, you know, being able to stay on Wesley a little bit more actually helps the scene. And he's like a true leader in this. This is one of the areas where we had some takes on this, where Wesley went a little bit too far with the comedy. I mean, it was always, there's that, you know, fine line between going over the top and it becoming broad comedy. I never wanted it to feel that way. And I think with Wesley's character and his kind of manic energy, it was very easy to just go a little bit too far. And we had a lot of variation in that scene at the pool table, where I ended up using one of the more subdued takes, actually. Now, this is another time Phoenix meets Spartan, and I wanted Phoenix to always have the upper hand each time they meet, the same way they did at the museum. And then Stallone has to overcome bigger circumstances, so he's always the underdog. And I think it's interesting, because, you know, that he doesn't have the advantage here. In the future, it's Phoenix who clearly has the advantage, because at this point Stallone's character doesn't really have the whole police force behind him, so he's got to kind of go on instinct and his own sheer determination to overcome you know, Phoenix always being kind of one step ahead. And Huxley actually proves to be quite competent, but at the beginning, you know, he's kind of dragging her along. I mean, she's only seen this stuff happen in videotapes and very little practical experience with hand-to-hand combat and that sort of thing. And we kind of drew her into the action gradually, and then later on there's a sequence where she gets right in the middle of the action. This was a really complicated sequence at stage because we had built the Mexican restaurant in this kind of container at the location, and then Wesley actually was doing his own stunts there. He went up into another location, which is a real elevator shaft somewhere else, and then we cut to another location after this. So we realized that this container is not what it seems, but it's actually an old freight elevator, and I find the way to activate the freight elevator. This was a shot I had to flop in post, and usually that's not a problem, but with Wesley we had one green eye and one blue eye, and some people noticed at the first screening that we had flopped that shot because his eyes had flopped around. And this is a scene that was a scene that had been cut there. He killed Zachary Lamb in that scene, but again, for pacing, we have to cut that scene, so he just gets into a police car. And this was shot at a real showroom out in Irvine. This is where we start the first major chase scene. And this is where I had a little bit less control over the backgrounds, because in the chase scene, I was very worried about having to shoot like a futuristic chase scene. And there were only a couple of areas where you had the right kind of, you know, streets and the right kind of background, and up in, you know, we use the street that's often used to double San Francisco in downtown LA where the car originally jumps over, and then this is the tunnel that was used in a lot of movies. Blade Runner shot there, and that's also in downtown LA. And the reason I shot in the tunnel is just to get some kind of art direction in the background without having to build too much and having to build too many structures, because you have very little control you know, when you're shooting something that has to be this dynamic, and if you just go for the look and you just go for the art direction, you often, you know, just sacrifice all the dynamics. And it was more important here to get a really exciting car chase. This is the car, basically is the Swiss Army knife of police cars. It does practically everything on voice command. And the storyboards for this sequence were very elaborate, and one of the ideas came from the way the ultralight, the way General Motors had designed the ultralight, which was that it would have an engine pod that could be removed to function as an electric car or as a gasoline powered car, depending on whether people were driving it in the city or on the highway. So part of this chase scene involved Stallone climbing onto the back of Wesley's police car, and then Wesley actually ejecting the engine pod from the back of the police car and leaving Sly behind, and then him dumping the car. But again, at the last minute, it was very difficult to build a car that way, so we weren't able to do that. So then I came up with something else, which was, you know, Sly just jumping on the roof and using the machine gun through the roof, and then using the doors to kind of act as natural obstacles to get him off the car. All of this was shot on the Imperial Highway section down in El Segundo in L.A., and this was not yet open to traffic, so all the cars you see are our cars. And we shot for 3 nights with about 50 of our own futuristic cars, and then in the background where you just see headlights, I was able to use rental cars just to fill it in a little bit. And then all this is done on stage, so this is all intercutting. This is on location here, but the reverses on Stallone being banged into the sidewalk, that's actually a rolling carpet, you know, with a road surface on it, where we were able to push his face. He had a pad on the back of his head, so we were actually able to push his head down on the road surface. It was rolling on these very high-speed rollers on stage. And this was all done on stage, and I think the smoke really helped it, and we were able to do a lot of stuff that tied in very well.
Self-drive.
this is great. I love this whole section where he finally gets control too late and isn't able to avoid smashing the car right through the sign here. And we thought of what's the next step from airbags, and now that we've got, you know, side impact, head impact, front impact, airbags, what would be the most kind of exaggerated version of that? And there's came up with this idea called the safety foam, which is basically like an instant setting foam that would be ejected into the passenger compartment. And at this point, you know, Stallone's character just doesn't know what hit him, and the whole car is like engulfed in this kind of safety foam. Used a lot of fluorescence in locations like this, you know, just to, again, get some of the art direction back in a very nondescript locations. We had these loose fluorescent units we would mount everywhere to reflect in the water and on the streets. And this safety foam rig, we had an accident. We were testing it, actually, because it was shot out of air cannons at very high pressure, and we went out to the special effects shop to do the first test, and we had a stuntman in the car, and the pressure was set much too high on the air cannons, and we actually injured the stuntman. He was fine afterwards, but he was very badly shaken up, and it blew the glass out of the back of the car. And then we were able to figure out a much safer way of doing it, because it had to be Stallone in the shot. So we found, by using many more air cannons at much lower pressure, we were able to do it with Stallone actually in the car. And the thing about working with Stallone, which is really good, is there was no hesitation on his part to do his own stunts. Like, actually, most of the time you'd have to talk him out of doing certain things that could be dangerous. I'd seen Benjamin Bratt's work in a movie called Bound by Honor, and we needed a really interesting sidekick for Lenny Huxley, and he had such a great innocence about him, and very likable, and very comfortable with, you know, his relationship with Huxley, although he was always the more conservative one. And here in this scene, we see him finally kind of taking action and getting involved, and he's become part of the rebellion now, and he's risked his standing in the police force to do that. And Benjamin and Sandy worked very, very well together. I think they really complemented each other, because they were both very innocent, but she was always kind of she considered herself the rebel, whereas he was always the kind of voice of reason in the scenes. And it was a very different role for him to play, because he's usually playing much tougher guys, and he's very good at it. People are terrified of you. What's new? This is when all the elements in the film, kind of at this point in the plot here, we're like at the beginning of Act 3, into Act 3 a little bit, and we see that everything that could go wrong has gone wrong now. So Phoenix is now confronting Cocteau even more aggressively than before. The scraps, the people from the wasteland, are now a part of the plot. And all the elements are kind of about to collide, and there's a lot of tension here. But Phoenix's programming, again, has saved Cocteau in this scene, but then Phoenix finds a way around it here. You can see the whole lighting design and the whole feel of the movie has changed here. Everything was shot much more dramatic, and a very different look from the way we're used to seeing these locations. This is like Cocteau's worst nightmare. Glenn Shaddix was very good. We had seen him in Beetlejuice, and we wanted he was a very comic character to play off Cocteau's dryness, and I think they worked really well together. Now, of course, he's jumped on board Phoenix's band instantly. You know, his loyalties kind of not the best part of his personality. This is back at the LA Convention Center. He shot for a couple of nights there. Sandy wanted to become very physical in the movie, and we were looking for a scene which would showcase that, because her character kind of comes from a place where she hasn't had a lot of a practical experience, but we thought that maybe if she had studied the ways of the past and the violence of the past, she would have also maybe taken some courses in karate and judo. And one of the first things she did when she signed on to the film was to work with a trainer for a couple of weeks, and we worked out this great choreography for her to beat this guy up. And I remember at the first test screening, we got such an incredible response from her, you know, the audience watching her kind of take control here for the first time. And this was a very important moment for her character, because this is the first time, she's talked about violence and her fascination with the way society used to be, but now that she's actually shot someone, it's a very different way of approaching violence, a very different kind of impact it's made on her than she would have expected.
Rest in peace, Raymond Cocktail. Oh, Jim Spartan.
The camera work from here on is always more... I tried to keep the camera moving as much as possible at this point in the movie. So, and editorially, we're, you know, pacing up and leading to the big climax. And the scenes are told more in shorthand. So, you know, in the setup scenes, we have, you know, scenes that would be running 3, 5, 7 minutes. Now we have scenes that are running maybe just over a minute. And just the bare... you know, necessities of the information are what we need. So again, the scene was originally longer in the first cut, and then you find an editorial, you want to really be able to keep the pacing at this point, because we know the audience is a little bit ahead of us here. They know that there's going to be this big confrontation between Stallone's character and Phoenix, and we want to get on with it as quickly as possible. And at this point, the audience is really on Stallone's side, and he's got just enough equipment now and just enough confidence that he feels more comfortable in this new world, and his attitude is changed from in the opening, when he was very kind of tentative about being in this futuristic world. Now he's more comfortable and he's adapted to it already. This was also a scene that was cut and then put back into the movie. I had it in the original cut, and then we took it out. And originally, we had a reverse of where you actually saw him kill all the guards. And again, it felt a little graphic, and it felt a little bit too harsh for the tone of the movie. So the compromise I came up with was, let's just show Phoenix shooting the guards, but let's not show what happens to them. See, I think that's the most complicated part of any movie, is just keeping the tone consistent. And I think in this film, you've got a lot of kind of social commentary going on, and then a lot of fun with what society could be and what it's become. And I think this is what kind of sets the movie apart from a lot of other futuristic movies, is that I tried to do something where we'd have some insight into, you know, this is the way society is going, and if, you know, everything has to be in moderation, and even trying to control everything to the nth degree is not going to work, and it's not going to be the right thing. And we want to show the flip side of that. This sequence was probably the most complicated to shoot in the entire film, because I had something like 40 liquid nitrogen canisters, sparks, strobe lights, steam effect, which looked different from the liquid nitrogen. Then we had the robotic claw that was built and rebuilt twice to work properly. It was a very complicated piece of equipment. It had to be very reliable because it was interacting directly with the main, you know, with Stallone, and it would be very difficult for me to shoot a lot of the stuff with the claw with a stuntman. So I actually had Stallone in the claw being lifted up and rotated around the set, so it had to be tested and retested to make sure it was safe. And a very complicated piece of equipment and hydraulics, and every shot had so many effects people working on it. It was, again, very time consuming to shoot when you've got that many elements to deal with. A lot of that was shot with a remote camera, actually high up in the set, so you could get a sense that Stallone was actually suspended above the set. And most of the shots you see of the claw are actually Stallone in the claw, not his stunt double. and he would just keep going up, and if, you know, if we needed to do more takes, he was, you know, just jumped right back into the claw and been done the next day. It was incredible. This is also interesting because it's just the two main characters now. Everybody else has been, you know, wiped out or killed, and now you have the two main characters very much like we saw them in the opening at the abandoned building that eventually blows up. And it's, you know, the final confrontation, and it's history repeating itself. Basically, like, the same confrontation that happened 30 years ago is happening again in this very, very different setting. And they're using every possible bit of technology here to gain the upper hand. So Phoenix has a certain advantage here because he's in control of all the equipment. But Stallone's character, Spartan, keeps coming back and finding different ways of getting out of the traps here. That's the same device you saw earlier used to cut the ice disc out of the floor in the reanimation sequence. And this is him having taken the focusing lenses off it, and now it's become this much more powerful laser beam. But a lot of dialogue was written for this scene, and ended up cutting most of it, because all you really needed to see are these two people kind of facing off before their final confrontation, and you really get the sense that at the end of the scene there's only one of them is going to be left standing. And you really didn't need a lot of dialogue to get that across. And this fight choreography, most of it was actually done with Stallone and Wesley Snipes doing their own stunts, and it was very, very you know, time consuming, very hard to do, because you know, very physical. And Wesley was able to wear much more padding than Sly was able to wear because of the wardrobe, so it was also very difficult for Stallone. I remember before we were all getting very tired at this point in the movie. This was like about the 95th day of shooting, and before we shot the scene, I got the sound playback guy to play the theme from New Jack City, and then the theme from Rocky, and got everybody very excited and the energy level pumping so we could get the necessary adrenaline flowing. This is great. I love this shot, like Phoenix kind of getting ready to finish him off, and then finally this is the first time Spartan has been able to use the technology to his advantage to gain the upper hand, and we see the crystal that's been established earlier in the film, and all in this the blink of an eye this event takes place, which freezes everything that's connected to the liquid on the floor, and Stallone is just able to escape by getting on the claw just at the precise time. This was very tricky to shoot. We had an air cannon built into the body so that we could not only get the head to break off at the right time, but we were able to get shards of the frozen blood and flesh to kind of split into different directions, and the head was actually made out of a very fragile kind of resin that was also frozen with liquid nitrogen, and we dropped it on the floor and shot it at 300 frames per second to get it to explode that way. And this is not a miniature, this is the real set actually blowing up. So we released all the canisters from the top, we blew up the crane. This was an optical done at LA County Prison downtown, the exterior. But that's something that you would usually do as a miniature, but since we didn't need to shoot the set again, it was built in so many different components, we were able to actually do it full size and get the flames looking exactly right and the scale of it to be exactly right. This was one of the last nights of shooting. This was outside of the prison building downtown LA, and this was basically the payoff to all the characters, and you know, Spartan has made things right, and even the police chief is now overwhelmed with emotion there, and probably talking to someone from below for the first time in his life. Originally, we had more of, I mentioned Stallone's daughter, Stallone's character's daughter was underground, and she was also involved in this scene. It just became very cumbersome and very complicated, because I think in a movie like, I mean, you've really seen the climax between the two characters, who what the movie's about, and now this kind of payoff. We were trying to do many different things, like show the fact that Dennis Leary's character is now going to be accepted in some way in this new society, and maybe they've gained some kind of understanding through, you know, Stallone's incredible persistence and his kind of, you know, barbaric ways. They've learned to understand them and not to fear them as much as they did before. And this is the kiss that Spartan has been waiting for since the virtual reality scene. And maybe everything's going to be okay. What I'm most pleased about in Demolition Man is the sense of humor of the film. I think in a lot of action movies tend to get very generic, and it's all about a series of beats, and it gets very formulaic. And I mean, this has, to a degree, this has some of that kind of structure, but we're always playing off the way the world's become and what, you know, moderation is all about. And I think tonally, it was really interesting to play with some of the things that are going on now about political correctness and how, you know, if we're not careful, we could become a very dull society. And I think the comedy, especially using Stallone as this character, you know, this kind of barbaric cop, worked very, very well for me, and very enjoyable to do. And I've always really liked science fiction, and I think science fiction is about the way, you know, to some degree it's about social commentary. And I think this has a fresh kind of look, and we never, you know, want it to be patronizing, we never wanted it to be too serious, but I think there is some good subtext in the movie, and hopefully entertaining as well in the action sequences and the characters that you can get into. It was very well received when it first came out, and most of the comments from the good reviews were about the social commentary and about the kind of pop culture sense of humor we had about the film. So I was very happy about that, and it actually made money, so we went a little bit over budget in shooting it, but we made our money back, so that was also good. And I hope you enjoyed listening to the commentary, and I'll see you next time. Thank you.